This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I love learning how magicians work. Not the magic tricks so much as everything around the magic tricks. They have to use their powers of performance to basically convince you to make certain decisions that you're not aware you're being persuaded or almost hypnotized into making these decisions. They have to misdirect, they have to entertain, they have to convince you that you're seeing real magic. And the techniques for that are not just good for magic, but they're good for public speaking. They're good for, in my case, I've experienced them in stand-up comedy, but also in everyday social situations when you want to wow and amaze people or persuade people or create a feeling of anticipation around what you're going to say and do. Anyway, I talked specifically with the magician, Steve Cohen, not my old producer, Steve Cohen, but another, or not the billionaire, Steve Cohen, or not the congressman, Steve Cohen, but Steve Cohen, the magician, who I once saw do a magic show many years ago. He's really great. He's done 5,000 magic shows in New York City. Some of the stuff he's told me just blew my mind. And then he even did a trick on me. Here's what he did. He listed five things. I had to say four things that were true and one thing that was lying, and he picked out the lie instantly. He describes this and many other techniques, very specific techniques that are useful, not just sleight of hand stuff, but useful techniques for controlling whatever situation you're in. So here's the great magician, Steve Cohen.
And three of them were used in the TV show. One of them was never used in the TV show. And that's the one that this wealthy client of mine happens to own. So he lives in Detroit.
He bought the Batmobile like in an auction or something?
He bought the Batmobile actually directly from the builder. And it's the only one that's actually built with a proper engine. It's not plexiglass. It's not, I mean, fiberglass. There are fiberglass Batmobiles that were made just for car shows and for appearances in shopping malls and stuff like that in the 60s. But this is one that's actually kind of was the rogue Batmobile that was never used, but it could actually drive on the highway.
Does it have fire come out the back?
Yeah, you can do it. He actually didn't have it set up, but yeah, it's all set up that you could actually flip a switch and then there's like a propane tank in the back that, or butane that shoots out fire from that little rear port. It was a dream come true.
And so did you drive it?
I sat in the driver's seat and took a bunch of photos, but then I sat in the passenger seat as we drove around Detroit. And here's the part that's interesting. So the guy who owns it asked if I wouldn't mind looking behind me. There was a SUV, a black SUV, that was being driven by his security guy, who's like an ex-FBI CIA guy, to make sure that we have, you know, security. Because when you're driving around downtown Detroit, you're in trouble already. But then if you're driving around in the Batmobile, you know, it's an extra level of craziness.
Man, that must have been fun. So Steve, I have a bunch of notes in the book. So occasionally I may look away to look at my notes.
Sure thing. Did you get the other books that I gave to Jay that to send down?
Yes,
to you?
Yes, I got the Win the Crowd book.
Because I gave this one to Jay also. This book from Asseline, you know Asseline, the publisher?
Oh, I'm sure I got it, but you know what? I didn't see that. Like, my family opens the packages and then the books disappear. But I saw the Win the Crowd.
Too bad. This is actually the thing that just came out recently. And forward was written by Guillermo del Toro, the film director. And he actually had me, after doing this forward for the book, he actually then asked me to be in his next film. So I had two scenes with Bradley Cooper acting in his next film coming out in December.
Now, let me ask you a question. Bradley Cooper, I think he's a good actor. Like, did it feel to you like he was a good actor?
He was fantastic. Fantastic. He was so friendly. Like, he was like, you know, for an A-list celebrity, he could have just blown off everyone on the set. He came right over to me. He walked up, shook my hand in the beginning of our two scenes together. And it was just two of us. It wasn't like, you know, an ensemble. It was just, you know, Bradley Cooper and me. And so he came over, he shook my hand. He said, "Steve, I've heard so much about your show. I'm sorry I missed it." Because he was supposed to come to the show at the Palace with Guillermo del Toro. He missed it because he had babysitting issues. So he's like, "I'm so sorry, I had to take care of my daughter, but I'm going to come back to your show as soon as we can." So that was just great. And then in between each take, Bradley Cooper was just cracking jokes and making me feel really comfortable, you know, because when you're around a celebrity, sometimes, you know, big A-list celebrity, you can freeze up a little bit, right? So he was making everybody at ease, and especially me. We had a great rapport.
Oh, that's awesome. So, and what was it like acting in a movie? Did you feel like you could do it? Like, you know, you're a performer, but sometimes performers aren't necessarily good at pretending to be other people, which is what acting is.
It's true. That's true. Now, fortunately, I had a lot of acting in high school and a little bit in college. So, you know, I know I understand the idea of getting into a part, but I had what would be considered a cameo. It was an uncuttable cameo, is what Guillermo del Toro called it. So, you know, I didn't really have to do too much character development or training for that part. The one thing that was great about being in the film was learning how to be directed by an Academy Award-winning director. And that's a whole different experience. For example, there was one scene where I was leaning in towards Bradley Cooper, and we took the shot and everything. And then after that, then Guillermo yells, cut. And he says, now I want you to do the same scene again, exactly the same, but put all of your weight on your back foot, on your left foot. And I didn't think that would mean anything different. I mean, what's the difference between putting your weight on your front or putting your weight on your back? But it actually shifts the dynamic between the two characters, even that small shift of weight. And it really made a difference for the overall picture of the screen. So even though it feels like you're only moving 4 or 5 inches, that even the 4 or 5 inches to the camera and to the eye, it looks like an entirely different scene.
Wait, so I'm trying to understand. So you were leaning towards Bradley Cooper in this scene, and obviously in most situations, someone would put all their weight on their front foot or most of their weight on their front foot. How do you put your weight on your back foot in that situation, and why would it make a difference?
Okay, so you know, I talk about this in the book, Win the Crowd. So, you know, if you put your feet at a 45-degree angle, right? Yeah. And so now, you know, your pressure of your weight is balanced pretty evenly. And so if you put your weight on your back foot, on the curved foot, the angled foot, you know, you end up kind of leaning back away, your shoulders almost leaning away from the audience, right? It's a little bit unsettling, right? It feels a little bit like you're off balance.
I'm doing it right now, and I know I'm doing it because I'm actually lifting up my front foot.
Right, you're almost on your toe, right? And so you feel like you're almost off balance, like leaning back, like maybe someone's about to push you. And in that dynamic for that particular scene, it was better if I didn't look like I was too eager to help this guy. But when you're performing on stage, like when I'm performing on stage, I hardly ever am leaning back unless I want to create a rest position. And, you know, with magic, it's all about tension and release, creating those peaks and valleys of interest. So it's a similar thing in comedy, you know that better than anyone, James, right? So, you know, if you're always getting people too riled up, they can't relax. So it's helpful sometimes when you lean into an audience and then you can lean back to let the moment kind of just settle and kind of gel.
Yeah. So it's interesting because a lot of times, and I've seen quite a few magicians, including you, Steve. So I everybody should know I saw you perform at the Palace Hotel. It was a great performance and really had a fun time and incredible magic, of course. But it really does strike me like a comedian or a salesperson or, you know, a politician have a lot of similarities to magicians. Like a comedian in particular, the magic trick is when, you know, you set up a premise and then they're expecting one thing, but the punchline is really a misdirection in using magic terminology. It's a misdirection so that it's a little bit of a shock to the system, and then they laugh once they understand that the misdirection is funny.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, magic, I think, is predicated on surprise. And so if I tell you up front, I'm going to be locked up in these chains and I'm going to escape from these chains. That was Houdini's act, right? Escapology. There's nothing really magical about that. I mean, it's very impressive that someone can train themselves to do that, but there's no surprise at the end. So I don't know if you can call that magic. It may be more of an allied art of magic. But, you know, magic really needs a surprise. And like a punchline in a joke is clearly, you know, a surprising ending, right? But it's always better if it's not telegraphed. And so I think that's where the beauty of magic is that, you know, people are expecting one thing, they get hit with something else, and that's where the kind of cognitive dissonance arises and makes you laugh and makes you surprised.
Well, that's the key thing, is the real meaning, the real truth in what's happening can't be telegraphed until the last possible moment. So the real trick, for instance, let's take the Houdini example. He says in the beginning, I'm going to lock myself in this thing and there's going to be chains around, and it's going to go underwater, and I'm going to be in a straitjacket. And then he's down there too long, so it almost feels like the audience is thinking he didn't succeed. We got to break him out, and it's going on and on and on. And then let's say he falls from the ceiling all wet while the crate is still down there.
Well, here's the best version of that, James. And this is very vivid memory for me from the 70s when I was a little boy. Doug Henning, remember the hippie illusionist with the mustache and the sparkly suspenders? He actually did a version of that Houdini water torture cell on one of his television specials where he was locked inside of the water tank upside down. They put a cloth in front of it.
By the way, I think I remember watching this, but go ahead.
Right? This is riveting. It was riveting television.
Yeah.
And the clock is ticking. They're saying Houdini's best time was, 1 minute and 35 seconds or whatever it was. And now it's ticking past that, beyond. And the guy comes out from the side with an axe, with a hood on, and he's ready to chop open the glass of that water's torture cell. And then they drop the cloth. The cell is empty. And the guy holding the axe was Doug Henning. So he had escaped and become his own savior.
Right. So I think it's always that, what do they call that in, you remember that movie, The Prestige? They call that, magicians never use this word before, I think, but in this movie, The Prestige, Michael Caine calls that moment the prestige when
that's artificial terminology for the film,
but it's a nice way of it.
Sure, it's a nice way of putting creating a definition for that moment for sure.
So I want to just say that you're a great magician, but this book Win the Crowd is useful for any example in life. I was thinking at first in terms of stand-up comedy. I have to actually perform tomorrow, but I was thinking, then this is good for any social situation at all. And we'll get to some examples, but I was thinking about your thing of loading the pocket, where you basically put something in someone's pocket or shirt pocket or whatever, and it becomes a source of conversation later. And
sure,
it reminds
sure.
me, a lot of what you do is preparation for a possible moment later. Like you give the example of the magician, I think it was in Chicago, it was Jimmy Grippo. Yeah, and he throws, like the night before, he's at the bank, and he notices the vault door closing, so he just flips a card right through there, no one notices, and the nine of hearts is in the bank vault.
And the vault is sealed with a time lock until the next morning.
Right, and so the next day he goes to the bank, and he kind of, fans out some cards, pick a card, any card, and using magic techniques, he's able to force them to pick the nine of hearts. They think they're picking a random card, and then the card disappears or whatever. And later on, he shows it in the locked, sealed vault, and they think they witnessed a miracle. And
exactly.
So I like how, but there's an out also. If he got caught or observed throwing it in the nine of hearts, he just doesn't do the trick the next day.
Right, or you just apologize. Oh, sorry, it fell out of my hand.
Yeah. So I like that. I like this idea of almost setting up, almost diversifying like lots of possible moments, future moments in your life. And I like this concept. Like what are other, and I know we're going out of order a little bit on the book, but this is a fascinating concept.
Well, I can give you lots of examples. I mean, a lot of them come from the world of magic. One of my heroes is a man named Max Mellini. Max Mellini was alive in the late 19th century, early 20th century, died in 1942. But this guy, he performed for kings and queens. I actually wrote a 500-page book about him that's coming out in August.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So he used to go around the world, and what he would do was he would hide playing cards all sorts of odd places, behind the pendulum of a grandfather clock in a hotel in Hong Kong, underneath a carpet in someplace in London. He'd go to, San Francisco, and he'd fold up a card and stick it inside of a barrel of butter. I mean, like all sorts of places. And he kept notes of where he kept what cards. So when he went back to those cities, those places, those hotels, he walked in and he was armed. He was basically armed, right? He was ready to go perform miracles because he had basically seeded the entire world with cards in cool places and odd places that people would never have expected that he could have prepared.
I love that idea. Now, what would you do if let's bring it to you know, you're not a magician. Let's say you work in an office with 100 different people, or let's say, you know, now everyone's remote working. So let's say you have a bunch of friends. Like, how would you use this technique even amongst your friends?
But one of the things that I taught in Win the Crowd was if you have any sort of fear of interacting with other people, and a lot of people are kind of, you know, they're comfortable enough dealing with strangers, but not really to the degree that a professional would be, like a professional salesperson, a professional comedian, a professional magician, someone who's used to dealing with the public in general, you know, is different from the average person who's not really as comfortable maybe dealing with strangers. So one of the things I taught in the book was to hide a quarter in your hand, okay, in your fingers, behind your in your finger palm area. And then when you meet someone, just during the course of conversation, pat the person on the shoulder and try to drop that coin into another person's pocket or into their purse or into their jacket pocket or some place that you can reach without making it seem too awkward. And the reason for doing this is to feel that you're kind of in control of that situation. It's like you have some inside knowledge now that the other person doesn't have. Like you've invaded their space, but you've done nothing illicit, right? You haven't stolen anything from them. What this would be called in magic is not pickpocketing, but put pocketing. And what it does is it just gives you extra confidence if you're dealing with people. Like, there's no need for me to be afraid of this person. I've already entered their world.
Does that work? Like, do you, like, so I, like right now I'm imagining doing it, but you know, as is the case in many situations, you don't really experience something until you do it. So I haven't yet experienced the feeling. Like, does it change your feelings in the situation?
It does. It makes you feel powerful. I mean, when the same way that Max Mellini performed with, you know, having the card behind the pendulum and the grandfather clock and walking into that room, knowing that he's got some ammunition, he has something ready to go. It gives you a kind of a sense of confidence that you probably haven't felt before, because it's almost like the tingling anticipation before meeting someone on a date for the first time. Like, you're like, what's this going to be like? How's it going to go? Don't worry, I've got this covered. That's how it feels.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So now let me go to some of the things I've highlighted. First off, I want to cover the maxims of magic, which aren't, you know, you talk about, you know, magicians don't reveal their tricks, don't repeat a trick, whatever. But these maxims of magic are very interesting. It's be bold, expect success, don't state, suggest, practice, 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 and be prepared. And I want to deal with the first, third, and fifth. Be bold.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so being bold sometimes, like you go onto the stage and you have to kind of exude confidence that you own the stage somehow. You can't let the audience think you're nervous, for instance. You have to exude confidence. And let's say someone's going into a conference room with all their bosses and they're asking for a raise. So a very difficult, high-stakes situation, maybe akin to performing. How can they be bold?
In this case, I wouldn't necessarily call it being bold. What I would talk about in this case is giving the person the sense of confidence. And the way to do that, at least what I do, first thing is to be familiar with the surrounding, the physical surroundings. You know, if you're going to do a show someplace, it's always helpful to what they call tread the boards in advance, to get to the place early, walk around the space, feel like you actually own the space to some degree, even if it's not your own office or your own stage. You know, I've got my own showroom, right? So I know where I'm going to be. It feels very comfortable. But when you're performing, or if you're entering someone else's space, if you could somehow get into that area a little bit early, just to feel confident about knowing the parameters of the space, I've always found that to be helpful. The other part also is before you enter the room, and I do this off stage in my own shows, is I like to do a very deep breathing exercise. And this may sound silly or pointless, or it may sound superfluous to someone who's trying to ask for a raise. But, you know, a lot of times we go into situations and we look a little deflated because we may not even believe in ourselves. So what I often do is backstage before I'm walking on is I'll do three very deep breaths. I learned this from yoga class when I was in college, but you know, you take a deep breath first, filling up the bottom of your lungs and the middle of your lungs and the top of your lungs. And then while you're still kind of full of all this air, that's when I walk into the room. And I call this floating into the room, because you're so full of air at that point, it's like you're a balloon. And believe it or not, it actually helps you exude confidence.
Are you, you're still on the inhale when you walk into the room?
Yeah, I'm like just at the peak of being fully expanded. So, you know, obviously at that point, then you want to probably let it all out, but you, but that would, you know, make you look a little deflated. So I like to walk in at the peak of that last breath, and then I walk right in with a nice big smile.
And you must be exhaling while you walk in.
I don't like to exhale. I mean, I just walk in. I mean, obviously you have to eventually exhale, but I don't like to walk in looking like I'm like going, oh, here we finally are. It's more like I'm walking in with this great, almost like a theme song in my head. I'm going to go in there and show them something that they've never seen before.
You know, I was thinking about this while I was reading this section, like obviously, and I've seen you perform, obviously, you're projecting enjoyment and confidence and that you really appreciate that the audience is there. But sometimes I've seen other performers do almost the opposite and achieve almost the same effect. Like you walk in and you say, well, now, I'm just making this up, but well, now after seeing you guys, there's one thing I know for sure. I wish I was home. And, you know, like, and sometimes the audience laughs and they appreciate that also because it sounds really authentic. They don't feel insulted, in other words.
Sure, yeah. It just depends on what type of a character you've created and what you're portraying. You know, in my case, you know, I want people to feel welcomed and I want the audience to gel quickly. One way to do that would be to antagonize everyone or to show your own disdain for being there, I suppose. But like in my case, I love doing my show. Now, remember, I've done the show over 5,000 times. It goes close to 6,000 performances. When I did my 5,000th show, the mayor of New York declared a day in my honor called Chamber Magic Day, which was pretty exciting. I have a proclamation on my wall. I think that was de Blasio's best proclamation.
Maybe, yeah, the only one with actual positive consequences.
Exactly. But in any event, though, you know, yes, you could definitely gel an audience by, you know, making them kind of feel some antagonistic views towards you. But I found that the opposite works for my personality.
Yeah, and I guess if you really exude authentic disdain, they might not like you. It's just more of a joke, and they become curious.
There maybe
is a mystery. Is he really serious or not?
It's an artistic choice. Like, you know, because the character I play on stage is an extension of myself. So, you know, you might remember, yeah, I'm known as the millionaire's magician.
Yes.
And this may seem like it's crass. It may seem like it's, you know, kind of bombastic to call that. But, you know, the character that I'm playing, performing in a Victorian age ballroom where I'm wearing a white tie and tails, and, you know, everyone expects to see someone who's of that era, of that time. You know, someone who's walking off the Titanic, for example, if it ever landed. So the point being that, you know, people have an expectation and I try to meet that expectation. If I was performing for farmers in the Midwest, I'd probably call myself the farmer's magician.
Well, you know, it's funny though, like you talk about, you know, you have a chapter on commanding the room and a little bit is, or I am interpreting a little is that you almost want to seem a little larger than life. Like, you know, you have the chapter stick your neck out. And would that be a correct interpretation? Like, I was trying to figure out, like, sometimes, you know, you also write about this guy, Al Reese, who advises that you pare away everything in your personality that is superfluous to your target market. So what do you do when you're trying to kind of craft this larger than life personality?
Well, here's what happened with me. So, you know, like I mentioned, I started off doing magic for birthday parties, bar mitzvahs, corporate events. And, you know, I was just like every other magician. I was kind of a generic magician. And I talked with my best friend, who happens to be a marketing consultant, a guy named Mark Levy, who's really a genius. You should meet him. And Mark said to me, he said, what's different about you? Like, why would anyone want to hire you as opposed to any other magician? What makes you special? How would you be defined in specific and easy terms? And I said, well, I mean, I grew up in Chappaqua, New York, right? This fancy suburb of Manhattan. And most of my clients are very wealthy. He goes, tell me more about that. And I said, well, you know, I performed for David Rockefeller at his estate in Pocantico Hills. And I've done lots of performances for A-list people and country clubs, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, stop right there. He says, you need to change everything. You need to focus on being the magician for the filthy rich. And I said, if I call myself the magician for the filthy rich, I'm not going to get paid any. No, I'm not going to make any you know, gigs. I won't have a single client. He said, see, Steve, if you aren't willing to give up the $2,000 gig, you'll never get the $20,000 gig. And I said, okay, that's a good point. And I said, you know, I can't call myself the magician for the filthy rich because that's really outlandish. But I remembered that a magazine article had been written about me in Avenue Magazine, and they called me the millionaire's magician. And I said, I could call myself that. He goes, that's it. He said, drop everything. He said, I want you to make business cards. I want you to make stationery. I want you to call yourself the millionaire's magician. And I said, no way. Uh-uh, not happening. My parents said it was stupid. My wife said it was a stupid idea. Everyone I talked to, all my friends said, you know, they gave it the kibosh. And he said, listen to me, trust me. This is what you need to do. Just trust me. So anyway, around that time, I went to England and I did some shows for a whole month in London, doing shows for the public. And the British media ate it up. They said, there's the millionaire's magician visiting from New York City, performs at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, millionaire's magician, performs for, you know, all these A-listers. And when I came back to New York, it was like a reverse import. And you know, the media reads the media. The New York media now was reading the British press, and they were saying, the millionaire's magician is back. And it reminded me very much so of when Houdini went to Europe and he came back. He was known as Europe's eclipsing sensation. And that was, he was a reverse import. You know, Houdini was, it was an American, but he was a reverse import, having had great success overseas. So anyway, that was kind of what started off my differentiation here. And that's sticking your neck out. Like I did something that was very uncomfortable for me. And that's, you know, basically just setting up a shingle and saying, I'm worth it. And, you know, of all the great things you can do in New York City, it takes guts. It takes real balls to hang up a shingle in New York City and say, this is what you need to come to, as opposed to going to Hamilton or the Producers at that time, or any of the big Broadway shows, going to Carnegie Hall. Instead, I think you should come to the magic show. You see what I mean?
Yeah. And so the section right after that says uncover your hidden traits, which I agree is also very interesting. Like what makes you unique? It's like you said earlier, why would someone come to see you as opposed to, let's say, another magician? Like what? So on the one hand, there's the branding, the millionaire's magician, but then there's kind of the inner stuff that,
sure.
What makes you unique as a personality or as a magician? And what would you say were those hidden? And by the way, you describe this as a process of self-discovery. I think everyone should do this because not everyone's going to go into, you know, wear a clown suit and go into a conference room and ask for a raise.
Of course,
like
not.
It's not about that. It's about bringing out these traits that are integral to who you are, but haven't been revealed yet.
That's right. Yeah. It's definitely a process of self-discovery. Obviously everyone has a true self, kind of an inner core. And we're often confused about who that is. Now, I happened to find my inner core very young. Knowing it very young allowed me to refine over the years. But I know people who are my age, I'm 50, who still are working on that. They still don't know exactly who they are. And they're kind of just floundering and wandering. And it's very confusing for me. Like, why what's taking you so long? But I guess certain people have their own path.
What do you think your hidden, what were your hidden traits that you uncovered even at such a young age?
Well, you know, I always had what my aunt, my great uncle was a magician. He was an amateur magician. And his wife, my Aunt Viola, once said to me, Steve, you know what you have? You have the gift of gab. And that stuck with me. And so I always knew I would be a talking performer. And, you know, when it comes down to it, like in my environment, like I'm in total control. Off stage, you know, I tend to just kind of casually banter with people and chitter chatter, but I still love to have a good laugh with people and have a, you know, have a fun time. And I know that, you know that world because you live in the comedy club, you know, scene, you know, there's certain people that are just really good with banter. And I love all the back and forth and the Broadway, Danny Rose, you know, back room. Like for me, that's what life is worth living for. So for me, like finding that part was integral, knowing that I had what was called the gift of gab. But the other part was knowing that I was dedicated enough to practice and, you know, finding that part of myself, knowing that, you know, I'm not shy about saying it's going to take me 10,000 hours, for example, right? Just pulling out a random number here, 10,000 hours to learn how to do this invisible sleight of hand move that no one will ever see. But I'm fine with that. It's you know, that's the crazy thing about being a magician is that the art is concealing that art. So I'm working so hard to create something that you'll never see, and I'm fine with that. And that's also why you don't have a chance, because I've put in, let's say, 10,000 hours for something that takes maybe a 3-second interval of your time. So what are the odds of you actually catching me on that, right? It's an unfair advantage.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the practice maxim. And one of the subsections when you talk about that is practice your outs. And I think this is incredibly valuable. Do you want to describe what outs are? Because, by the way, this is great for entrepreneurs. This is great if in a social situation. This is great if you're asking for a raise. But it's particularly important for magicians.
Yes, I can explain what an out is. So there was a great book that came out, I think, in maybe the 1940s or 50s, that's called Outs, Precautions, and Challenges. It's a book for magicians, and it teaches, what do you do if the trick goes wrong? What do you do when the trick goes south? What happens if you have an audience that challenges you and they're aggressive and they purposely foul things up? So, you know, the idea of a magic show is you always have to come up with a successful conclusion. Otherwise, it's not a magic trick. It's not magic, it's tragic. So the idea really is to have in the back of your head a plan B, C, D, E, and F. And these plans are called outs. And those are basically the avenue that you would take if your original plan doesn't go well. So the difference being that you should never let the audience know that you're going down one of those outs. So if a trick goes wrong, I shouldn't be like, oh, rats, it fouled up. But here, let me resolve it. That's a really poor way of doing it. You know, what you need to do is you need to live in the moment, right? You need to be using time to your advantage with situational awareness, so that you're kind of like seeing what's happening before it happens and looking back at yourself kind of almost from the future to see where it's going and say, oh, crap, this isn't going the way I need to go. I'll stay calm. I'll stay collected. But I'm now going to take plan B, and the audience will never know the difference. And that's really what the key is, that it's a seamless transition into plan B or C. And it might be a branching anagram, right? Where like you're going from plan B and then go, oh, plan B isn't working either because these people are on to me. Now I'm on to C. But again, it has to be seamless. People can't know that there's anything that's off kilter. And that's really where the practice comes in. So you have all of these different outs ready to go, and they're planned and not a surprise to the performer.
What I notice, for instance, in the comedy world is that sometimes someone will slip up the wording in a joke and have to, you know, and like you say, you can never admit it. You never could say, wait, let's rewind. Let me start that joke over. And you have to kind of just roll with what you're doing. But then that in itself becomes funny somehow. Like you, and I've seen Louis C.K., slip on some words and then go off into a whole other segue based on the word usage that he did. It seemed like an accident. And then you realize later, or when I was thinking about it later and analyzing the performance, I realized that was probably planned. His plan B was actually, what seemed like his plan B was actually his plan A probably.
Right. Absolutely. I've heard that about Louis C.K. And that's, isn't that brilliant that, what appears to be a mistake is actually the intended route. That's really great. I've never done it that way precisely, but with magic, it's there's a trope in magic, which is the magician is in trouble. And because the magician is in trouble, apparently, then the audience gets really, they lean in from their seats going, oh, how is he going to get out of this? But that trouble was actually premeditated. So, that it's almost, it's such a trope that it's almost, callous to do that to an audience, especially if people are seasoned magic watchers. And these days, because of the way the world that we live in, people have seen a lot of magic on YouTube or Penn and Teller's Fool Us or other shows. People are kind of getting hip to that idea of, okay, this guy's not really messing up. He's trying to make me, he's playing with my heartstrings. But the funny thing is, I've had situations where I've genuinely messed up a trick, and the audience goes, okay, we know that you're just messing around with us right now. What are you really trying to say? And I'm like, no, I genuinely messed up. And so they're like, no, come on, really. And I'm like, no, really, I really did mess up. So, that does happen. The more you perform, the more likely that sort of the percentage is going to be that you'll have a foul up. But, you roll with it. You say, this is live theater. We're going to just keep moving on.
How did you become a magician? Like, obviously you were interested in it. Like every kid is interested in it for some period of their childhood, but then you stuck with it, became obsessed. Like, what aspect is talent? What aspect is skill? How did you stay persistent when things were difficult?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great question. I started when I was 6 years old. My uncle, as I mentioned, was an amateur magician. And, you know, there was just something about you know, being able to fool adults when I was a little six-year-old boy that made me feel very powerful. And the problem is that as you get older and you continue to do magic and become an adult yourself, you might, if you're still doing magic for that reason, you're in trouble, right? Because that's very needy. But in my case, you know, I kind of realized that it wasn't about me. I really genuinely enjoyed giving people that reaction. I got a kick out of watching the reactions of the audience's faces. Because, you know, you can, if you're a comedian like you, you can make people laugh, right? That's like your, that's your currency.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I haven't seen your act recently. but if you're, you know, a musician, or you can make someone tap their toes. But what a magician does is a magician makes you wonder. And you didn't get a chance to see my new book, but my new book from Asseline, it's basically a book full of photography of audiences in shock having watched my magic show. And you see these black ovals, which are basically the people's mouths open because they're in such awe. And I'm not saying that it's because I'm such a great magician. It's because magic as an art form can generate that reaction. That's what magic does. It makes you feel like your bottom has dropped out and I just don't know where I am anymore. Am I living in a dream? What's going on right now? So that's, for me, that was like a drug. And I wanted to get more of that. And I wanted to give people more of that gift. So all through high school, I was performing birthday party shows. Like I mentioned, when I was in college, I went to Cornell, which I think you went to Cornell too. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. When did you start there? I'm a little older than you.
Okay, yeah. I went there from 89 to 93.
Okay, so I graduated in 89. So but I stayed the summer. So it could be the case that we overlap for one day.
Yeah, there you go.
At Cornell.
That's hilarious. Go Big Red. And anyway, even at Cornell, I was doing shows. I did a show for Carl Sagan, who was a professor there at the time. You probably remember.
Yeah, and I saw that in the book. So I actually, you know, was curious if we were there at the same time. But
oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. I'll tell you the funny story about Carl Sagan. So when he called me, it was my, I think it was the winter of my freshman or my sophomore year. And I got a call during winter break. And the guy on the other line of the phone said, "Hi, this is Carl Sagan. Can I speak with Steve Cohen?" And I thought, this has got to be a prank of one of my college friends. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that it's one of my college friends. And I picked up the phone, and sure enough, it was really Carl Sagan. And he asked me if he had heard about my close-up magic, and he wanted to know if I could come in and perform for a group of visiting astrophysicists. And I was a little nervous because these are some of the brightest minds on the planet, right? These are some of the really brilliant minds in science. And so anyway, I came in. I gave my performance, gave a lecture about sleight of hand and misdirection, and at the end got a standing ovation, which for me was like one of the highlights of my career, not just as a college student, but my professional career.
Believe me, that was the highlight of your college career as well, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, for sure, by far. but then the best part though is I asked him afterwards, I said, "Professor Sagan, do you think that you could write a letter of recommendation for me? Because, you know, coming from you, that would mean a great deal to me in my career." And he said, "I'd be happy to write it for you." I said, "Okay, well, here's my address." He goes, no, I'll hang on to it." I said, "Well, what do you mean? What if I want to give it to someone?" He said, I'll send it to them if it's necessary." I said, "Well, can't I have it?" He said, "Don't worry, Mr. Cohen, it'll be in my vault. And my vaults will remain for a very, very long time." And anyway, then he passed away and I never was able to get that letter of recommendation.
Oh my gosh.
I contacted his wife, his widow, and we couldn't find it. So anyway, it's lost to antiquity.
You should have said, "Look, even if you hide it from me, I'm a magician. I'm going to be able to get it." And then maybe he would have given it to you.
I know. I was thinking about that actually, right? Like Kreskin, right? Kreskin would have his paycheck hidden anywhere in the auditorium, and then blindfolded, he would go around the auditorium and locate his own check. And by the way, Kreskin also would say, "If I can't find my check, then I don't get paid for this gig."
Oh, that's funny.
That's confidence, right? That's confidence.
Now, people wouldn't think he would know in advance that it was there, where it was.
No. I mean, because there was a committee of people that they would confer amongst each other, and they would hide it in some cockamamie place. Like they would hide it, you know, inside the stuffing of one of the person's seats in the auditorium, that they'd like tear it open and then sew it back up. Or they'd hide it inside of like, you know, the flute of someone in the one of the flautists in the orchestra pit. You know what I mean? Like someplace that's really unlikely to find. And he would unfailingly find his check.
How would he find it?
That's something it's called muscle reading, to put it, you know, kind of in the broadest terms. It's something where you touch the person who knows the answer and let their subconscious muscles push you in the right direction around the theater. That's the cloaking of it when you're watching it on stage.
Ah, and is that possible, that muscle reading? Could your muscle reading be so fine-tuned that you can really feel where their muscles are kind of pointing?
Theatrically, yes. It's certainly possible in a theatrical setting. It would be very difficult for someone who's not trained to do it. I mean, there are subconscious signals that we give off all the time. Like you probably are familiar with the pendulum, where the automotor cues from your fingertips are making the pendulum swing or turn into a circle or stop, move in all sorts of shapes, like an infinity shape. So you know, it certainly is something that we're capable of doing. But on a stage, you know, of course, we can exaggerate and we can make things even more theatrical.
So you have a chapter about or a section about reading people. Like maybe describe that a little, because that, of course, is something that people are fascinated by. There's lots of BS books about reading body language, and there's some real techniques out there that work. And what have you found to actually work and be good in any situation?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that I do in the show is I give the illusion of being able to read people's minds. And you might remember I have everyone in the audience, and this is at my shows at the Waldorf and my shows at the Palace Hotel, where everyone is, you know, asked to write down some secrets about themselves, whether it's, you know, where they had a secret tattoo, or maybe they have some crazy addiction, or maybe they, you know, did something odd in their high school summer vacation, and things that there's no possible way I could know, things that nobody could find about them on Facebook or on social media, things that only they would know. And then I go around the room one by one and start to nail every one of those with you know, 50 or 60 people around the room. And I'm telling this person, your dog is named Penny and you kissed a girl named Holly. And, you know, you have a tattoo of an anchor on your left ankle and all these sorts of things. One of my favorite ones, by the way, was when there was a lady, and this is at one of my first shows, who was very hesitant to let me read her mind, because what she had written down secretly on her card was that she was a nanny during the daytime, and at night she was a professional dominatrix. And nobody in the audience was expecting that, and certainly not me. So you saw these ladies in the front row turn their heads around and stare at the lady afterwards who had written that, and in utter shock.
And you did this from reading them, or did you have was there some other trick involved, like you knew who put what into the hat?
Oh no, I never know anything in advance. That's the brilliance of this, of my methodology for this particular trick. And again, I'm not going to give away any of the secrets, but there is a secret to it. It's a very intricate one, and there's no technology, no hidden cameras. I can do this in the middle of a cornfield. Some people say, oh, you must have cameras planted around the room or hidden devices. No, my methods actually go back to the 1400s, so the 1500s, you know, people were doing this sort of demonstration for centuries. But to answer your question about reading people, you know, mm-hmm. obviously most people are not going to become mentalists or mind readers or magicians. You know, one of the things that you can really pay attention to is what I like to call the clenching of people's jaws, and also the directions of people's eyes. And you know, when people feel tension, they tend to clench their jaw. I don't know if I wrote about this in the book, but you know, it's not, if you pay attention, it's very obvious. If you've never seen it before, you'll be shocked when you start to pay attention. But when someone is flustered or angry or upset, they start to clench their jaw, and it changes the musculature of your face. And so you can start to see if someone's lying or telling the truth. It's the same thing with the directions of the eyes. You know, if you ask someone a question and they start to look up before they answer, you know, most likely they're starting to formulate some sort of an answer in their head, not something that they know, but something that they're kind of constructing on the spot. And for example, if I asked you right now, and I can see you on this recording, if I asked you right now, and this may or may not work because we're talking about this, if I said, okay, I want you to tell me five things that you did this morning, but one of them has to be a lie.
Huh. Okay. So I just looked up, actually, just even thinking about the question. But do you want me to do it?
Or? Sure, we'll give it a try. I mean, I guess it's going to be challenging only because I've already told you what I'm looking for. Okay. But go ahead. And why don't you look at the camera while you're doing it, too?
Okay, yeah, I'll look at the camera. So I ate 3 hamburger buns. I which I eat a lot of carbs. I watched several videos about chess. I watched some comedian videos, and I kissed my wife when she woke up. And I also asked my daughter how she's feeling today because she had her wisdom teeth pulled.
Okay, the only one that you didn't shift your eyes on, which is interesting, was the one where you said I watched some comedian films.
So that's really interesting. That's the one that was a lie.
Yeah.
So exactly. So instead of looking up,
but you see the difference is in this case, and I was just looking at you on the screen here, and we're in different states.
Yeah.
So you're in Florida, I'm in New York, but still, yeah. Even from that distance, I was able to tell you which one was a lie. Right.
So right, and that's interesting because you know I'm interested in comedy. You don't necessarily know if I have kids or anything else, and yet you're saying that. So it's not so much the eyes looking up; it's the eyes doing. Is this the one time the eyes are doing anything different?
Right, but remember, since I happened to call attention to it in advance, you might have genuinely been flicking your eyes around to counterbalance that, you know, to kind of throw me off. So I
no,
was,
you know why
I was able to find the one that was the atypical response in this case.
You know why I was moving the eyes around, actually, because I was thinking of this while it was happening. I wasn't trying to do anything tricky or fancy. I have trouble remembering what I did in the morning. Like, I can remember what I ate for breakfast maybe on a random day when I was 17 years old, but this morning, I can't really remember so well because, you know, the day gets packed and you
of
sort
course.
Of discard short-term memory sometimes. And so I had to remember I had to think about what I actually did, whereas the lie, I've just made it up on the fly.
There you go. You see? That. But you tried hard, but you couldn't give me a porky pie.
Yeah, there you go. So all right. So, but back to what you did to become a magician. Like, what were some of the, let's call them micro skills? Like, what did you have to learn and really practice to get on this road to mastery of your power?
I don't know where that power leads me, but I'm not going to overtake the world. But, you know, one of the things that I always wanted to do was I always wanted to make a difference, right? So, you know, being a magician is fine, but I wanted to be, you know, a noted magician. I had kind of these lofty dreams of being recognizable, being when people think of a magician, they think of me. And so, you know, I think having that great sense of self-confidence is kind of the baseline. It's the, you know, the self-love or self-worth. That's really important to, if you want to become a performer, you have to already feel loved on your own without the need for another audience to kind of validate you. I mean, it certainly helps when you get that response, but I don't think it's something that should be what feeds you. Your what feeds you really is your own self-confidence, your own self-worth, and your own self-love. So that actually helped me early on, having a good family that always supported me when I wanted to go out and do a magic show. You know, most Jewish parents, obviously my last name, Steve Cohen, I have a Jewish family. Yeah, you know, most Jewish parents want to have a physician, but mine ended up with a magician. So, you know, the point being that they were always really supportive of shows. They would drive me before I had my driver's license to do performances. So I think that's kind of the baseline first, is having a support team, people who really care about you, that they support you. Even if you're trying to do something which is a little bit outlandish, if people keep on saying, no, you can't do it, no, you can't do it, then, you know, you have to overcome quite a hurdle. But if people are always supporting you, my mother was always willing to take another card. If I said, Mom, take a card. Okay, whatever she was doing. You know, it wasn't ever a bother for her. And I think that's part of what kind of kept me being encouraged, was just knowing that my family was behind it. But then as far as the micro skills, obviously the sleight of hand, it's like practicing the piano or practicing the violin. It's incessant practice. And, you know, during school, I had cards and coins in my hand. I was always flicking things around between my fingers. And that was part of the joy of growing up for me, was learning. And I learned from not only magic books, but there was a magic camp, a summer camp. You know how they have baseball camp and soccer camp? There was actually a magic camp for young magicians that I went to and later became a counselor at. Now I go back as a guest performer. So it's just a way of giving back to these young kids. In any event, so the incessant practice, And the reason that I like to
sleight of hand was like, is that like moving the quarters between the fingers?
Sure, you know? Sure. Yeah, like that's called the steeplechase when you make the quarter run across your fingers. The steeplechase, definitely that sort of thing. But also like learning how to shuffle a deck of cards. For example, I don't know if you can see this through your monitor, but I can take any deck. And by the way, I sent you a bunch of cards. I don't know if you got these, but I sent you some cards that I made. If you take a look at the monitor, you'll see.
I gotta make sure they're. We just moved to this house. I gotta find them. I want this.
Yeah, I sent you because I made my own branded cards. And they're just beautiful. The top quality cards in the world. So yeah, I sent you a couple of decks when I did my 20th anniversary show. I made this deck, and the 5,000th show, I made this deck. So you can see those beautiful logos. Anyway, what I've learned to do is take any deck. And, you know, decks are from all different qualities around the world, and be able to weave them together in an instant so that every card is perfectly shuffled one by one by one by one without any variations. I don't know if you can see that, but I can do this, and many magicians can do this, but I've learned to do this behind my back without looking, just by touch, and be able to create what's known as a Faro shuffle, where every single card is interlaced, single card, up, down, up, down, up, down, without any variation at all. And I could do this one-handed. I could do it behind my back, like I mentioned. You can name a number from 1 to 52, and I can make that card be the one card that's off in the count. So in other words, if you say like 24, then I can go and weave these together, and now you can count down to the 24th card. You'll see that there's two cards right here. Do you see that? That there's two cards there instead of a single one. And that's simply because of massive amounts of practice. So the practice itself is the joy. And, you know, they say that the journey is the destination, right? You know, that enjoying the practice is actually, for me, has become part of the whole magic experience. Because then when I go in front of an audience, I'm utterly relaxed. I'm never doing something that I haven't done thousands of times before. So that's what gives you the utter confidence to walk in front of a stranger and show them something that is essentially a confrontation.
Wow. So like how many hours do you think you actually were practicing some form of sleight of hand or shuffling or whatever?
No exaggeration. I have cards in my hand morning, noon, and night. I've been doing magic every day since I was six. When I leave the house, I have a deck of cards in my jacket pocket or in my bag. And it actually gives me a sense of confidence. Like I'll pat my pocket to feel that there's a deck of cards in there. And I know that it gives me confidence because I could be anywhere and start a show if I had to. And I'm a little bit less inclined to do that now. But, you know, when I was younger, especially in trying to make my mark and being in New York City, which, as you know, is a big city, but it's also a small village. You tend to meet similar people all the time. People have seen you, people have heard about you. So people would stop me on the street and I get stopped all the time. People would say, hey, you're the magician. Can you show me something? And if you're not ready to do something, you're like, well, actually, I don't have my doves with me. You know, so having a deck of cards has always given me that extra sense of confidence.
So when you graduated college, did you move to New York and start trying to be a magician? Like, what was your first kind of leap into it as a career?
So after Cornell, actually at Cornell, I met my future wife. She's Japanese. And so we moved to Japan together. And I actually speak Japanese at a native level. So when I went to Tokyo, I was working first as a translator and an English teacher for a short time. But then I ended up getting a gig working at the Park Hyatt Tokyo, which, if you've ever been to Tokyo before, it's one of the best hotels in Asia. So I ended up performing there for some really heavy hitters because of the clientele. And the thing that I learned from that experience, James, was when I was working at the Park Hyatt on Sundays, I was also working on Fridays at this other club in the Ginza area, which is also a very fancy spot. But it was a down market, kind of a pub, like a beer hall. And I was doing exactly the same magic tricks for the downmarket bar as I was for the highfalutin people in the penthouse floor of the Park Hyatt Hotel in Tokyo. And the reaction I was getting at the bar was nearly as good as I was getting at the hotel. And I realized that the surroundings, the venue, helped to create the experience. And that planted a real seed in my head. So when I eventually moved back to New York, I was doing a little bit of work here and there as a magician, but it wasn't really going anywhere until I had this idea. What if I was going to perform in someplace grand? What if I kind of made this into a very intimate and elite type of high fruit on the tree that you have to reach for event? And so I started doing the show at not a hotel yet, but at the Gramercy Park National Arts Club, this beautiful, beautiful club you've probably been to. And so I did the show there for a couple of months. And then at the very last show, someone invited me to the Waldorf Astoria. I ended up doing the show there for 17 years.
Wow. So it was pretty, so you basically learned what your environment was. And then how did you get in Gramercy Park? Did you just, did they ask you, did you approach them or did you rent the room?
Yeah, at heart, I'm an entrepreneur. So like everything I've done has been self-produced. You know, people have asked me, okay, will you come and perform at the Magic Castle? Will you come and perform at my comedy club or wherever? But I like to do things in my own environment because to me, that's part of what the experience is. And I learned that from that dichotomy that I told you about in the bar and the fancy hotel in Tokyo. So you know, doing the show in the penthouse of the Waldorf Astoria, where people are going into this special lobby, the Waldorf Towers, where only the president usually comes in with the Secret Service, and you're going up in an elevator up to the 42nd floor, walking down this hallway, like everything you're going through is a picture frame, a mental picture frame. And each picture frame gets more and more grand until you're walking into this room where the Duke and Duchess of Windsor used to live half of the year, you know, and they've got their grand piano and their tapestries and whatnot. It's just, you know, the environment, even before the show starts, has set you up to say, this is going to be something else. It transports you. And that's where I think magic needs to be. It needs to be kind of a transported world so that you're feeling that you're living in a dream, even though that you're awake.
I'm wondering if that's a little from your personality and that you like the grandness of those situations. But like take someone like Chris Angel, his personality might be more where he likes the dive bar performing there, something like that.
Sure. I mean, again, everyone is their own artist, right? And your artist, your artistic mind speaks to you. Your heart leads you in the direction that that speaks to your story. And, you know, I realized that my story happens to be one of that I grew up in, surrounded by wealth. I wasn't a wealthy guy, but I grew into it. And, you know, creating the Millionaire's Magician character actually has, for me, defined my business to such a kind of laser focus that, am I a millionaire? Yeah, the business has turned into an incredibly lucrative one, but only because I was able to kind of pare away, like we talked about before, things that were extraneous. If someone said to me, okay, would you want to come and do a show at the dive bar? Now I would just simply say, no, it's not for me. If someone says, would you like to perform on stage for, you know, for 5,000 people and we'll pay you an exorbitant fee? The answer is going to be no, because I know I'm not the right person for that. And now I did do a show, having said that, at Carnegie Hall. I'm one of the first magicians in about 75 years to do a one-man show at Carnegie Hall. Wow. But that was the smaller hall. They have a 250-seat theater. So I did and that show sold out in about 2 hours, which is really very flattering. But having said that, though, I kind of know my limits. And I think that's partially what an artist needs to be able to do, is to know where you excel and to put yourself into that environment.
Yeah, like what would you say are your limits? Like, let's say, what separates you from, for instance, a David Blaine, who has, you know, really hit this, you know, A-list celebrity factor?
Sure. Well, you know, David and I have known each other since we were 14. We both met at the Magic.
Yeah, you mentioned
camp.
you were a consultant to him as well.
I was a consultant on two of his shows, and then also we've known each other as friends since we were 14 years old, because we met at the Magic Camp that I told you about. We were both campers there, which is hilarious. And he's been very supportive and very gracious over the years. When my first son was born, David Blaine sent us a beautiful baby gift, which is something you don't usually give, but he gave us a cashmere outfit, all cashmere for my son, for my baby, and a cashmere teddy bear. And so, if you have kids, which I know you do, you know, having to wash vomit out of cashmere is not really that much fun. But anyway, so going back to David Blaine, he's been greatly supportive, really good friend. But we focus on different things. I'm trying to create a fantasy of your meeting a master of magic. In his world, in his case, I think that David Blaine is already considered to be a magician, but he's showing things that are human oddities or things that shouldn't be able to be done by the human body. But he's able to pull them off nonetheless, like sticking a spike through his bicep or swallowing frogs or staying underwater for 15 minutes. You know, these are things that people shouldn't be able to do, but he's able to do it. And I remember going to see David Blaine's show in Brooklyn when he did a show at the King's Theater several years back. And I was on a subway coming home from Brooklyn, And there were a bunch of people in the subway car that recognized me because they said, oh, we've been to your show at the Waldorf Astoria. Oh, we're glad we have you here. Tell us how David Blaine did everything. I said, I'd be happy to. It's easy. He just did it. He swallowed the frogs. He stayed underwater. He stuck a needle through his bicep. And so, you know, I'm happy to help him, you know, perpetuate his myth because he's doing the real work. And, you know, in my case, I remember I've done the bullet catch. Unfortunately, you didn't get my new book, but there's a whole chapter in there about when I did the bullet catch trick for my TV special on the History Channel. And I ended up in the hospital because there are some things. I ended up with a shard of glass that was between me and the shooter. The glass shattered. The glass came straight at my chest, shattered at my my bicep and my my pecs. And I ended up with this massive blood tumor that kept on growing. And I had to go to the hospital to explain it to the doctor about how I got shot by a bullet and caught the bullet in my teeth.
Did you have to stop the show?
That was fortunately a TV show. So we were able to just stop the shoot right there. But we captured everything on camera. You saw me go down. You saw me go to the hospital. It was pretty crazy. But the reason I bring that up is that having done that, having risked my life and having learned that, yes, this has consequences, now I stick to the illusion of danger, the illusion of of some sort of suspense, so that this way there's no true danger to myself, my family, because this is not a blood sport. It shouldn't be. It's meant to be entertainment.
You know, you mentioned earlier you have the gift of gab and you realize it early on. And I like some of your suggestions for people in terms of taking command of the audience or the situation. You have this one, ask a personal question back. So if someone gives you a compliment, you turn the conversation back to them. Like if someone says, you're the best magician I've ever seen, you say, thank you. Have you ever been to Las Vegas? You'd love the shows out there. So I like this technique.
Yeah, this is something I really highly recommend that people check out. You know, there's a magician who I actually learned these ideas from originally from, I believe he lives in New Mexico now, or perhaps Arizona, named Kenton Nepper. He put out a booklet in a series that was called Wonder Words. And his idea was that you can take verbal patterns and make these do some dirty work for you. And one of those is the method that you just mentioned, which is to kind of respond with a question. Because, you know, really, if you're always absorbing this praise, right, it makes you feel good, but it makes the other person feel like they're left out. So you can then flip it back to the other person. They give you praise, give them something, some thanks, but then respond with a question back to them. And finally, it will ultimately include them back in the conversation. Another Wonder Words technique that I think is really great is combining two commands with the word and between them. And the example would be, for example, let's say I have a piece of rope and I say to someone in the audience, sir, would you please hold this piece of rope. The guy can say no, right? He might say, no, I don't really want to hold this rope. Or if I say to this gentleman, sir, please stand up, right? He might be like, why would I want to stand up? It'd be an embarrassment in front of all these people. I don't want to put myself in the limelight. But if you say those two commands with the word and between them, sir, please stand up and hold this rope, invariably, they will not have any hesitation. They'll stand up and hold the rope. It's like clockwork. And the reason is because it's easy to deny one command, but not two.
You've seen this in practice. Like you've seen it where if you give one command, a higher percentage of people will say no than if you give two commands.
Oh, all the time. I mean, this is the whole show. I'm doing it and people are not even aware of it. So, you know, I mean, the basic example would be, you know, please take any card and show it to your friends. That's an easy one, right? You know, I've had other people say, no, I'm not going to show it to anyone, but take any card and show it around, or take a card and put it in your pocket. This way I know they're going to take it without looking and put it into their pocket. So by just stringing two commands together, it just short circuits the ability to deny either one of them. You could try it with your kids. You know, for example, you can say to them, you know, take out the trash and mow the lawn. I mean, maybe they're not going to do both of those, but do your homework and I'm just thinking this. My kids don't do their homework, so this is not going to work.
Good for them, by the way.
But thanks a lot. But you get the idea. You know, just try it. You know, here's a better example. So, put away the dishes and hang up your laundry. You know, those may be too much of a distraction, but you'll just experiment. And you'll find ways to get your children to say no less.
I wonder how you can use this technique in comedy.
You know, I've never tried. You're definitely a better joke writer than me. So I don't know.
Your act was very funny, by the way. I was thinking you're a natural comedian.
Thank you. You know, it's funny you say that. You know, I don't see myself as a funny person. I watch comedians like you, and you know, I'm in awe of the ability just to stand on stage without any props and be able to command an audience and just keep the rhythm and the flow going. So I commend you on that, and you're really a master of that.
Oh, thank you. What other comedians do you like?
Oh, you mean aside from you?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, one of my big, I've actually tried to get her to come to the show. I had Peter Sagal from NPR, Wait, Don't Tell Me, came to my show once. And I was thrilled, you know, he was just so great. And I asked him if he could help me get Paula Poundstone to come to the show. And I've tried to get her to come. She still hasn't come yet. But I really like Paula Poundstone's ability
to do
crowd work. She's so good at that. And that one of the parts of my show, Chaper Magic, is 20 minutes of crowd work where I'm doing that mind reading segment I mentioned earlier. And the ability to just stand on your feet, not know where you're going, and really just be an artist in person is for me just a joy to watch. So I love seeing people like Paula Poundstone do that.
Now you also have the aura technique, which is a technique actually I've used, and now I realize after reading your book that it's an actual technique. But you want to describe that one?
I mean, how have you used it before? I could explain it, but how have you used it?
Okay, so like if I'm giving a talk and I might approach the audience and say, listen, I came prepared with three different talks. I can talk about, let's say, Bitcoin or entrepreneurship or your relationships. And I always know, and then I'll say them again and I'll use the or, and they'll have to clap for each one that they want. I always know that they're going to pick the last one.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, oftentimes there's the idea of primacy and recency, right? And so the most recent one that they hear, which is the last one, is the one that they'll clap for the most. It's kind of a common thing in that sort of, where you put your hands over people's heads, you know, on stage, the last guy will be the one that usually gets the most applause. But the way that I use the word or is when you're offering someone almost like a false option. So for example, would you like to shuffle these cards or, and the person goes, no, don't worry about it. And the answer,
I see what you're
the
saying.
The word after the or, they fill in their own head, which is the word not. So would you like to shuffle these cards or, and then in parentheses, not. And the people respond, they fill in that last word in their own head, even though you don't say it yourself. So would you like to shuffle
if they're waiting for you to finish the sentence?
They're waiting for you to finish the sentence, and then they complete it for me. And that seems like they made their own decision. So for example, would you like to shuffle these cards or, and I shrug my shoulders. And they go, no, don't worry about it. I say, okay, terrific. Well, you had the chance. And, you know, maybe I didn't want them to shuffle the cards because I have them set up a special way or arranged, or maybe there's, you know, something, some order that I've preordained. Maybe the top card is one that I want to keep there. For example, if I wanted to do a second deal and keep the top card on top, well, pretending to deal off the top card and dealing the second card instead. So if I say to the person, would you like to shuffle the cards or, and they go, no, okay, terrific. And I'm all set for my next demonstration. And it feels like I gave them the chance.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And then what's like a, what would you say is like a real world situation where you can use this?
I don't remember what I wrote in the book. Maybe you've read it more recently than I have. This book, you know, I wrote quite some time ago, but was there an example that stood out to you? I could go back to some of the examples I had included in the book. I just don't remember off the top of my head. I call this the or trailing, because like you're starting a sentence and then you're not really finishing it.
Yeah. So, let me see. I'm going to find it in the book.
Oh, here it is. I got it. This is a good example. I just found it. I have my own book in front of me as a reminder. So for example, let's say that you're having, I don't know, some French fries or some, you know, you're having calamari with your friends at a restaurant and there's one piece of calamari left. There's one calamari that's on the tray and you say, would you like to eat the last one or?
Yeah.
Right. And the people go, no, don't worry. Go ahead. Right.
Right.
Or
everybody's
going
to say
I
no.
Left a little bit early, or no, go ahead. We're all finished here. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, it's not as hard as you think to come up with a solution. You have to just think about what you want, and then kind of throw the word "or" in there, so that they say no, they say not. So, for example, you know, is there a problem with this? Or the person, no, there's no problem. You see, so there's lots of different ways you can create examples of in your daily life.
And so, you know, in the book, there's a little paragraph where you mention David Blaine. You're working with David Blaine, and he gave you advice. He said, don't prepare what you're going to say. People should feel like you're talking to them for the first time. And yet when you're doing 5,000 shows, how do you avoid seeming too overprepared?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. You know, you've probably seen either Las Vegas performers or probably comedians as well, that they have almost a sing-song voice when they're reciting their script or their lines, because they've done it so many times that it doesn't sound genuine.
It feels
anymore.
Acted.
Right. It's just totally put on. It's totally, you know, preordained. And, you know, that's one of the big challenges I had to overcome when I was about maybe 3/4 of the way through those 5,000 shows. I realized, man, I'm getting burnt out. I'm saying the same things over and over again. I'm like a machine. And that's so dangerous when you put yourself into that state of mind. So the way that I do it, and this is, you know, this is not my own idea, is to think there's someone in this audience, maybe a little boy, that had to save up a lot of money. Maybe he had to save his allowance for, you know, for 3 months to be able to pay for one ticket to be sitting here. And I owe it to that little boy to give him a fresh performance, because this is the first time I'm ever going to perform this, and this is going to be the last time I'm ever going to perform it in front of these people. So it has to be genuine. And so I've basically convinced myself, I'm going to have fun. I'm not going to go out there and make it sound like I've done this before. And if I feel like I'm having fun, it'll come off as fresh. So the way I learned it really was in high school, when we used to have performances in my theater club. I was a member of my high school's theater company. And so we would do three or four shows per weekend. And our theater director, who was a really talented director, a guy named Phil Stewart, who also taught people like Vanessa Williams and Harrison Ford when they were younger. So he said to us, look, go out there and make it fresh. Convince yourself this is a fresh audience. You're going to perform it fresh. And so I just keep the word fresh in my head. And I just try to remember, this is not about my experience. It's about the audience's experience.
And, you know, all this stuff is so fascinating to me, because it's both genuine and it's a technique. So, like, I love the left to right technique, and I'm going to start incorporating it in my, like, let's say public speaking or comedy, but you could even incorporate it potentially in, you know, any social situation. But describe the left to right principle.
Sure. So, you know, we as a Western culture, we read from left to right. Okay. And maybe if you're in another country, in Israel, for example, it would be the opposite. But, you know, since we feel most comfortable seeing things from left to right, it often would help if you presented your information in that order, not from your own perspective, but from your audience's perspective. Remember, your right is the audience's left. So it doesn't make sense if you're going to present, let's say you're a salesman and you have three different products you're going to be presenting to your client, the least expensive, the medium, and the most expensive. And if you put them onto the table in front of or between you, and the most expensive one is to your right, and the least expensive one is to your left, for you, it would feel like a natural progression. Let's start from the left and go to the right. But to the audience, that would feel backwards. It would feel, like I mentioned before, some cognitive dissonance, because you're not starting in what would be the natural progression. So make sure that you're seeing things from the audience's perspective and beginning on the left and always going to the right. And if let's say you're giving a performance or a presentation, let's say you're giving a talk or you're a comedian, and you start your presentation and you're on your left side of the stage left, it's not going to feel as comfortable as if you were starting on stage right, which is the audience's left, right? So in fact, I would try to enter the stage. I try to, at least if I can, I like to enter from the audience's left. And this way it feels like the beginning of a story. Right? The beginning of the story starts here. The ending of the story will end at the other side of the stage. And I move slightly to the left, my left, their right, throughout the performance. It just feels like they can remember different vignettes happening, and they happen in different places on the stage.
How many people do you think know that? Like, how many performers use that technique? I've never even heard of this.
Well, I mean, if you're a stage director, you would be familiar with this for sure. But as a regular, you know, a college professor probably wouldn't know it. A comedian might not know it, but that's why we're all here, right? We're trying to learn something new. I mean, I'm not saying I'm the be all end all of stage technique, but I've just done it a lot and have learned interesting you know, tidbits along the way, and I've experimented a lot. You know, I've been a failure for a really long time. So, you know, I've tried all sorts of things until it finally started to click. And then I started to go back and say, well, why did that work? Oh, I see. Because I was standing in this area of the stage. Maybe if I do it again in that area of the stage, I'll find similar success. So, you know, even just your physical location in the room can change the direction or the flow of the performance or a presentation.
You know, it's also fascinating. Like, I could go on and on. Like, I encourage, there's the chapters on reading people. You give all these exercises too for building confidence. Like, you know, go when you next time you go to a movie theater, go to the very front of the theater and just stare back at the audience. You know, you could even pretend you're looking for someone, but stare back at the audience for as long as you can handle it, because it feels very uncomfortable.
Sure.
And you have all sorts of like exercises that are real world exercises that people could do.
Can I give you one that I think is really, really fun to try, especially on a crowded street in New York City or wherever you happen to be? It's the one that you might remember. It's called the 10 steps in blindness. And so basically what you do is, and this is to take in more information. I do this because as a magician, you sometimes have to take in a lot of information in a short amount of time and remember it, so that later on you can spew that information back out in a more measured way. But what I like to do to kind of get that massive amount of information in like a shutter of a camera is when I'm walking down the street, I close my eyes for 9 steps and open my eyes up only on step number 10. And then close my, and I take in as much as I possibly can during that one split second, and then close my eyes again and walk another 9 steps and then open my eyes again. And if you do this, I've done this in crowded places like Grand Central Station. You try to avoid getting bumped into. But if you're going to start off, obviously, in some place a little less risky, like inside of a park or some place that you're not going to trip or fall.
So also fascinating stuff. And there's obviously there's so much more in the book. And I know this one was written a while ago. It's called Win the Crowd. What's the book that you have? You know, and I just tried to find it on Amazon even.
No, this book the next book is called Confronting Magic. It just came out in January. It's not on Amazon. Asseline. I'm holding it to the camera for you to see it. Asseline is a really high-end book publisher for coffee table books. It's spelled Assouline. And so Asseline...
Assouline.
Right. And so they put out... You probably heard of Taschen, those really big, you know, beautiful coffee table books. Asseline is a competitor. And they've been in the business for like 30, 40 years. So it's a really established company. Their books sell for like $1,000 a piece. This is not one of those. This one sells for $60. So it's bargain basement. But it's covered in silk. This is actually, if you can see it, the cover is made of silk. And the book, as I mentioned, has a foreword from Guillermo del Toro, the film director. It's filled with photos of people who have the experience of watching magic. And in fact, I show different tricks in here, like my think-a-drink. You remember that trick, James? When I have the tea kettle that pours any drink that you ask for over and over again around the room?
Yeah.
So they
yeah,
had
that
these
was
pictures
amazing, actually.
Of the, yeah, there's pictures of the audience experiencing that. And if someone asks for a martini, they get a martini. But the next guy asks for a gin and tonic, he gets a gin and tonic. Next guy from that wants to have a hot chocolate with mini marshmallows, he gets a hot chocolate with mini marshmallows out of the same spout. The next guy wants to have, you know, a Manhattan with bullet rye bourbon or bullet rye, and they get that. So, you know, it's pretty amazing. That trick is highlighted in here. As well as the Indian rope trick, which I saw when I was in India. I've got a whole chapter about that. And all the celebrities I performed for, you know, like the list goes on and on. But there's a lot of cool photos of people being shocked. And also there's a lot of essays about magic that are included.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'm definitely, if I don't already have it, I'm definitely getting it.
Well, you have it. I sent it to you. Maybe you didn't get it. You didn't open it yet, but it's definitely somewhere in your palatial house.
Yes. And my, I don't know if I would call it palatial, but... you live in New York City, right?
Yeah, obviously. I'm on the Upper West Side, not far from your comedy club.
Oh yeah, because I've seen you at the comedy club. We've hung out there.
Well, that was the funny thing is that you have you collaborate with a guy named Steve Cohen, which is the same name as me, right?
Yes.
And I bumped into you and Steve Cohen out in front of Stand Up New York. So when one time you had a podcast, I listened to your podcast, James. I think that's, you know, that's how I first, you know, we first met.
Yes.
Is
yeah,
I bumped
yeah,
into
you
on
reached
the
out
East
to me.
Side and you, I was listening to your podcast and then saw you on the street at exactly the same moment. So it was hilarious. But when I saw a podcast on the queue list, it said James Altucher interviews Steve Cohen. I was like, shit, I must have missed that recording.
That's funny. Well, there's a lot of Steve Cohens, and you mentioned, for instance, you performed in front of the multi-billionaire Steve Cohen as well.
Yeah, I've performed for Steve Cohen, who owns the Mets now. I've performed for him 3 times. And the funny thing is, you know, I did one trick for him, which was probably the wrong trick to do. I took a dollar bill. Actually, I think I had like $4 or $5, and I changed them all into $100 bills. And, yeah, and everyone else like, around him difference? Was like, wow, that's amazing. And he's like, hey, I do that every single day.
Well, he's got a good sense of humor.
Yeah, he did. So, he was a great guy.
And so where are you performing now? How's it going with COVID and stuff? Like, where are you performing?
So during the pandemic, I purposely decided not to perform anywhere. I performed 0 online performances, 0 digital shows, 0 outdoor performances. What I did do, though, is I wrote this book for Masseline, which is it's a real piece of artwork that we worked on really hard. And also a 500-page book, which is coming out in August, about Max Molini, who happens to be my hero. He's the magician who used to plant the cards all over the world, like behind the grandfather clock pendulum. So I've done into his life.
You have to come back on the podcast when that comes out as well.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I hope we get a chance to do that again.
And then when things settle down, where do you think you'll be performing?
Well, contrary to some people's belief that New York City is dead, I've actually decided to reopen my show Chamber Magic, and it's already contracted. We're starting on June 4th. So June 4th, 2021 is the reopening day. We're doing the first performance as a free event for first line responders. So they'll have a chance to be thanked, and that's my way of giving back. I did the same thing during 9/11. I did the same thing for first responders down in the World Trade Center area. But it's just my way of saying thank you. So that first show is on June the 4th. But then we're doing shows every single weekend, Friday and Saturday, 7 o'clock and 9:30 p.m. at the Lotte New York Palace on 50th Street and Madison Avenue. Same location.
Yeah, that's where I saw you several years ago.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That's great.
We both looked a lot younger then.
Yeah. And then, okay, so how could people find the book? They go to ASSOULINE.com?
Yeah, the new book is from Asseline. So Asseline.com. It's also on my website, and if you know people get it from me directly, I could autograph it to you if that means anything to you. And that's chambermagic.com. So that's where you can find information about my shows too. And actually, it's nice to have a live calendar again, where people can actually buy tickets. But the shows are reopening on the same website, chambermagic.com. Well, and Win the Crowd, by the way, the book that you read, that came out several years back. That's on Amazon. You can get it as an ebook. You can get it as a hardcover or softcover. There's all sorts of versions. It's been translated into 7 languages.
Well, it's amazing, and I'm sure I'm looking forward to confronting magic as well. This next book, the book about Max Molini, and
I should change my name to Cohini.
Yeah, well, Houdini, right? Took his name from
Robert Houdin.
Yeah, right.
One time, I got an award. If you allow me a little bit of bragging, I got an award from the National Arts Club, that group I told you about. It was like a lifetime achievement award for the art of magic. And the guy who gave me the award was Dick Cavett, the famous old time talk show host who I'm really fond of. So it was a great honor. And one of the things he said is that when he was younger, he actually was friends with Johnny Carson. And Johnny Carson used to be called the great Carsoni. And so.
Oh, yeah, because he was a magician.
Amateur magician. He was a very talented sleight of hand guy. And Dick Cavett also does some sleight of hand magic, particularly with rope tricks. So Dick Cavett called himself the great Cavetti. And then he says, aren't we glad that the great Cohini doesn't quite work?
Yeah, that's funny. It wouldn't work. Well, thank you once again, Steve Cohen. You can find him at the Palace. You can find his latest book, Confronting Magic, at Asseline.com or chambermagic.com. And I also highly recommend Win the Crowd. And I'm looking forward to your next visit to the podcast. Thanks again, Steve.
Oh, thanks so much, James. It's great to talk to you again.